From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Chris Spurgeon. On today's Fresh Air, Terry Gross interviews musician Levon Helm. In 1965, he played in Bob Dylan's backup band. That group went out on their own and became known as The Band. The band has reunited with their first new album since the 70s, and Levon Helm has just co-authored a book about his life and work with the band. Also, poems of advocacy and witness, and a conversation with poet and lawyer Martín Espada about his poems inspired by what he saw as a tenants' rights lawyer. And TV critic David Biancoli reviews tonight's episode of Frontline about Lee Harvey Oswald. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate has approved a measure that would give the Justice Department new powers to stop violence at clinics where abortions are performed. The so-called Clinic Access Bill was designed to stop anti-abortion blockades at clinics and arrest violent protesters. The bill passed on a vote of 69-30 after the Senate repeatedly voted down attempts by anti-abortion lawmakers to reduce the penalties. Opponents of the measure argued that it would infringe on the First Amendment rights of peaceful demonstrators. In Mexico, nerves are on edge as that country anxiously awaits tomorrow's vote in the U.S. Congress on the North American Free Trade Agreement. NPR's David Wilner reports from Mexico City.
Many Mexicans seem only dimly aware that the fate of their country's economic future is being decided tomorrow in Washington, but among the intellectual and political elites, there's high anxiety about tomorrow's vote. A group from the ruling PRI party took out full-page ads in leading newspapers to accuse the leftist opposition of being in cahoots with Ross Perot. Many on the left are critical of the treaty, saying it will lead to an avalanche of U.S. products here that could drive less efficient Mexican industry under. Mexican President Carlos Salinas has made NAFTA the linchpin of his government's economic strategy, but yesterday he downplayed the trade pact's importance, possibly to cushion the blow if it doesn't make it past Capitol Hill tomorrow. I'm David Walnut in Mexico City.
Democracy negotiators in South Africa have raced through last-minute debate on an interim constitution. A final draft of the document is to be presented tomorrow for the approval of leaders of the 21 parties taking part in political talks. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
The summit of party leaders is the climax of a two-year process in which political enemies negotiated a plan for the peaceful transfer of power in South Africa. As negotiators neared their final deadline, they interrupted debate to hear President F.W. de Klerk praise that process.
Negotiation has proven, as we always believe, the only way in which to avert conflict and in which to ensure that all the people of this country will move forward together as a South African nation.
The interim constitution calls for a government of national unity to replace white minority rule. Elections for the new government are scheduled for next April, and any party that wins at least 5% of the vote will be represented within a new cabinet. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
Stock prices closed sharply higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 33 points to break through the 3,700 level for the first time and close at 3,710.8. Advances edge declines in heavy trading. This is NPR. A federal judge in Cincinnati has blocked the city from removing anti-discrimination protection for homosexuals from its human rights ordinance. Opponents of the protection argued that homosexuals are protected under current civil rights law and are not entitled to claim special protection like that given on the basis of race, gender, or religion. Voters approved the amendment to change the ordinance by 62%. The judge's ruling blocks the amendment from taking effect until the city decides whether to argue the case before a full hearing or appeal it. There was new fighting today between Israel and Hezbollah guerrillas in South Lebanon. It was the worst since Israel and the PLO signed a peace agreement in September. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
The clashes began at dawn when Hezbollah launched dozens of Katyusha rockets at the area of South Lebanon Israel calls its security zone, slightly injuring two Israeli soldiers. The guerrillas then attacked two Israeli outposts and six belonging to Israel's allies, the South Lebanon Army. One guerrilla was killed, but Hezbollah captured 12 SLA militiamen, the largest number in a single operation. In retaliation, eight Israeli warplanes bombed Hezbollah bases in eastern Lebanon near the Syrian border. Israeli officials say Syria was responsible for the attack and is protesting the fact that Israel has chosen to concentrate on negotiations with the Palestinians. The fighting came as U.S. Secretary of State Warren Christopher announced he will visit the Middle East early next month to try to push Israel-Syrian talks forward. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
With less than 48 hours to go before a strike deadline, American Airlines has resumed contract talks with its flight attendants union. The union's 21,000 members are set to strike American on Thursday if a tentative agreement hasn't been reached. The union went to federal court yesterday to accuse the airline of unfair labor practices. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Chris Spurgeon, sitting in for Terry Gross. When the album Music from Big Pink came out in 1968, it was an event in the music world. Our music historian, Ed Ward, wrote in Rolling Stone magazine, "Music from Big Pink was totally unlike anything my friends and I had ever heard, and everybody wanted to know one thing. Who are these guys, anyway?" These guys were a group called The Band.
If your memory serves you well,
the band first got together as the Hawks when they backed up an energetic rockabilly singer from Arkansas named Ronnie Hawkins. Levon Helm, the drummer, was from Turkey Scratch, Arkansas. He was the first to join. Then they moved to Canada where they found the other members of the band, Robbie Robertson, Garth Hudson, Richard Manuel, and Rick Danko. In 1964, the Hawks left Ronnie Hawkins to make it on their own. The story of how the Hawks turned into the band is told in Levon Helm's new biography, This Wheel's on Fire. In addition to the new book, Helm, along with Rick Danko and Garth Hudson, have put out a new band album called Jericho. Terry Gross recently spoke with Levon Helm. He told her that when they first went out on their own, they were getting a lot of work in clubs, but they really wanted to record.
That was our big goal, was to try and get in the studio and make records. And of course, the opportunities back in those days were a little bit on the skinny side. We met John Hammond, the blues singer. John's from New York. John would come to Toronto and come by the Concord, wherever we were playing, and jam with us, and we'd have fun like that. John put in a good word for us, and one of our first New York sessions was to record with John Hammond. We got to play with John and met Michael Bloomfield and some of the musicians that were around in those days.
John Hammond probably had something to do with Bob Dylan calling you up.
Well, I'm sure he put a good word in for us with Bob. Mary Martin, a friend of ours from Toronto, worked in Albert Grossman's office at the time, and of course they managed Bob and Peter Paul and Mary, several of the artists that were popular in those days. And we didn't know, but Bob wanted a band himself, and I think Mary and John Hammond sort of helped us along with that.
So what was it like when you got the phone call, when Bob Dylan called and said he was looking for a band? This was at about the time that Like a Rolling Stone was a hit on the radio.
That's right. Rolling Stone was out, and I think that was that particular album was the first time that Bob had used a band. And it was something new, something that he wanted to do. And I didn't know a whole lot about Bob. We were more into R&B and blues music.
Well, in fact, you're right that you thought he was too folky.
Well, we weren't big folk fans. We were more we liked more instruments. We liked rhythm section. We liked horns. We liked a full house on the bandstand. And Bob was coming from more of a troubadour, you know, just him and his guitar kind of a place. And I didn't really know who he was. I hadn't connected the name with the song, Like a Rolling Stone, that was playing on the radio. And he called us down at Tony Mart's in Summers Point, New Jersey, and asked if we wanted to play the Hollywood Bowl with him. And I said, sure, you know, who else is going to be on the program? And he said, just us. And we asked the colonel, our agent, if Bob could fill up the Hollywood Bowl. And the colonel said that he thought he could. And we had a couple of rehearsals, and we ended up playing Forest Hills with Bob. A couple of us, Robbie and myself, came out of our group, and he had Harvey Brooks and Al Cooper that he had played with, I guess, up at Newport.
You know, when he played at Newport, he was booed by, at the Newport Folk Festival, he was booed by the crowd there because he had just gone electric, which was very controversial. So,
yeah. Well, he was booed when we went electric with him at Forest Hills,
right.
too.
What did he give you advice on what to do if you got booed?
He told us, we had a little huddle there backstage before we went on for the second half. He played the first half by himself, and it went just smooth as silk, and the crowd loved it. And the second half, we huddled, and we knew. We had read and heard about, you know, things getting a little bit tough in Newport. He told us, whatever happens, don't stop playing. Just keep playing and give it a chance to settle down. And we did, and I don't know if it ever settled or not.
You left the band shortly after it became Dylan's backup band. Why did you leave it? I mean, this was like, in retrospect, a great opportunity for the group.
Well, it was, and, you know, I probably could have been smarter about it, but we had played most of the American part of the tour. Bob wanted to play Europe. He wanted to go to Australia, and so we played through the Northeast, which was pretty tough. Towns like Boston, they gave us a standing ovation of boos, and at the same time, we would hit Fort Worth, Texas, and it would be just another good rock and roll party. But it started wearing on me. I got to the point where I couldn't find enough funny things to laugh about it. I didn't feel like joking around all the time like I usually do. And rather than really make a boner, I decided that maybe I should let the tour go ahead to Europe and to Australia and some foreign places without running the risk of making a monkey out of myself. So I stayed back and waited on everybody. I went back to Arkansas and played with the Cate Brothers Band and kind of picked up where I'd left off playing dances and so forth.
So you rejoined the band after the band moved to the Catskills, which was after Bob Dylan's motorcycle accident.
Yes, ma'am. He had a bike, spilled his bike after they got back, so it kind of changed directions, and instead of so much touring, there was a lot of extra time, you know, to put music together. And Garth set up his Ampex tape machine in the basement there at Big Pink, and we started getting together and just putting songs together, and trying our voices, you know, finding out, you know, how to stack our harmonies and just things like that that helped us out later on.
Well, you write in your book that you think the song Ain't No More Cain, which is actually recorded on the basement tapes, was a real breakthrough for the group. What mm-hmm. did you think was a breakthrough about it?
Probably the voices. We would. That's when we first started swapping the lead vocals around. We would trade verses, and we found out a couple of different ways to stack the harmonies and the answers up with the lead vocals. So that helped us a lot as far as finding out, the different possibilities for our voices.
Well, let's hear Ain't No More Kane from the Basement Tapes.
All right.
Ain't no more Kane.
That's the band, and my guest is Levon Helm, who's co-authored a new book called This Wheel's on Fire, Levon Helm and the Story of the Band. The band also has a new record called Jericho. So when you moved to the Catskills, and the band was living in a house that was pink and was nicknamed Big Pink, did you move into the house with them?
Yes, I did. Moved into the house there. There was an extra spot for me, and we used it as our headquarters and music room for a couple of 3 years there.
What was it like to all live together and play together? It could get very insular. You could really get on each other's nerves in a situation like that.
Well, not for us. We had been doing this for years. We had traveled and shared the same bedroom and bed on different occasions. There had certainly been times when maybe we could afford two rooms, and after a few flips of the old coin, we found out who was going to get the couch and who might get an extra pillow and take the floor. So, no, we got along good, and things were a lot of fun for us. We had never had that kind of time on our hands. We had come from the school of playing six nights a week and a dance on Sundays if we could manage it, and of course Ronnie Hawkins could usually manage to book that extra night. So all of a sudden there we are in the Catskills, and we don't have a show to play that night. So we were enjoying it, just sitting around and the freedom to go down and play some music or go outside and throw a football around at each other.
So after recording in the basement, you finally got to record an album. The album was The Big Pink, your first album, but the band's name was not initially supposed to be The Band. What was it supposed to be, and how did you end up with the name The Band?
We didn't know what it was supposed to be, and we had signed an agreement with Capitol Records. It hadn't come to that yet. We were trying to sign an agreement, and we ended up signing the agreement as the Crackers, and we thought that was funny. And nobody else did, especially the record company.
Was the joke that everybody except you was from the North?
Well, that, we tried the Honkies just for variety, and they didn't think that was too funny either. But people referred to us as the Band. Bob's at the hotel, and the band is headed for the sound check. So on the Big Pink record, when it came time for the credits to list everybody's names, I think it said something like The Band, and then underneath it, it told you who all was in the band. So when we cut our second record, the record company kind of shifted that back around, and they liked that better than the Crackers.
It's funny, here was this band that had been on the road together for so long, right? And now that you had gotten used to recording in the basement and had an album out, you didn't really want to go on the road.
Well, you know, by the time we got our record recorded, we had learned a whole lot more than we had ever known before about our, you know, the way we sounded and the different combinations we could use by changing instruments around. So we didn't want to go on the road. We wanted to continue to record and try and refine some of our formulas, you know, to help us do better music. And we thought the closer we stuck with it, now that we had learned the fundamentals of playing music in a recording studio, we didn't want to go back to playing live and forget what we had learned. We wanted to kind of keep honing that particular style of chops. It's different playing in a studio than it is playing live, of course. So we had managed to develop some studio chops, and we didn't want to back away from it that quick.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Levon Helm. He's written a new book about the band called This Wheel's on Fire. The band also has a new album called Jericho. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Levon Helm is my guest. When did things start going bad for the band, within the band? Dissension and things like that. I mean, for example, you write in the book about how really annoyed you were when you'd see on records that Robbie Robertson had all the songwriting or most of the songwriting credits.
Well, that was a bit of a distraction. I didn't think it was quite fair. Not that Robbie didn't do a lot of the songwriting, most of it in some spots, but at the same time, Richard did some good work, and I always thought that that Garth and Rick and myself was there all the way, no matter whose idea the song was, or if it was halfway there, or... You know, it was finished. Most of our stuff then got finished under that workshop kind of circumstance, and that was just one of the things that came up that kind of created a little bit of tension in the group. I could see it, you know, hampering our collaboration, and it you know, started bothering the spirit of it.
Robbie Robertson, in I guess it was 76, decided he wanted to leave the band and that the band should break up and have this big finale concert and go out with a real bang. You didn't want the band to break up, so you tried to resist that, but I guess you weren't able to.
Well, I wasn't. By then, maybe the last waltz started back, you know, during some of the... disenchantment that I felt when the songs didn't reflect what I thought was the true spirit of things. So by the time the last waltz came up, it was no secret our collaboration and I thought that the quality of our music had suffered. I didn't hear us getting better. I heard us you know, doing albums with old songs that we liked as opposed to getting in and really trying to grow a fresh crop of songs. And so I certainly didn't want to end the band. The last waltz, you know, didn't set right with me. But, you know, there comes a time when we all want to move on, and that's what we did.
Martin Scorsese directed the film The Last Waltz, the film of the last concert performance in which there were lots and lots of guest stars. Did you like the film?
I liked some parts of it. Overall, I didn't like it a whole lot because I felt that some of the best songs and some of the best moments were still on the cutting room floor.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you ever reconciled with Robbie Robertson?
Well, at this point, there's not a lot of reconciliation that has to be done. You know, that was the way I felt at the time, and it's this much later now, and we're doing good, and Robbie's doing good with his solo career, so it probably all worked out for the best.
Hmm. Now, the band reunited in 83, but just a few years after that, Richard Manuel hung himself. Were you shocked by that? Did you see it coming at all?
You know, it's hard to see trouble coming. You know, at the time, I thought we were doing pretty well. We didn't have a recording contract, and there didn't seem to be one available for us. And what kept us going was when we played for the people. When we played music, everybody liked it, and we never had anybody ask for their money back. And I thought we were still sounding good, and we were evolving. It was painful, but I didn't think it was as painful as that, and I certainly didn't see it coming.
So do you think that his suicide had to do with his disappointment in what had happened with the band in terms of not having a recording contract and not playing big venues in the way that the band used to? Or was it much more personal than that?
If I had to hazard a guess, I would say that it was more personal, and I would also admit that where the band was at and how quick it looked like we were going to get to where we wanted to go, it didn't look as rosy as it could have. So whatever personal problems that anybody was having, you know, the situation with the band could be some discomfort at that time. None of us were satisfied with where we were at, and we weren't satisfied with how quick we were getting it changed.
Did you think about him a lot when putting together the new record?
Yes, we did, because we had Country Boy, which was the last song that Richard recorded with the band, and it was a great tune, a great performance on Richard's part, and we were never able to get it finished and to finish the other songs that needed to go with it to make up a whole album. So it didn't get to come out when we thought it would, and when we finally managed to put the rest of the songs for Jericho together, I don't think it occurred to any of us not to use Richard's song.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we close with something from the band's new album, Jericho? Is there something on here you'd particularly like to hear that you're particularly happy with?
Well, the song that they're playing up in Canada, and they tell me that it's a radio hit, which is unusual for the band. I think maybe Cripple Creek got up to number 15 or 20 in the old days, and the first tune on the record, Remedy, it's called, has got some good horn parts in there. Garth plays some good organ, and we're having a hell of a time.
Well, let's hear it, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Levon Helm has a new book called This Wheel's on Fire, Levon Helm and the Story of the Band, and the band has a new album called Jericho, and this is Remedy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I'm not afraid to die. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Chris Spurgeon, sitting in for Terry Gross. Poet Martín Espada fights oppression in deed and in word. He's been a tenants' rights activist, and his poems have been described as giving dignity to the insulted and the injured of the earth. Coming up, Espada reads from his new collection of poems and discusses being both an activist and an artist. And TV critic David Bean Cooley previews tonight's Frontline report about Lee Harvey Oswald. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has approved a measure aimed at protecting abortion clinics and doctors from violence. The bill would make it a federal crime to attack abortion clinics or doctors who perform abortions. The vote was 69 to 30. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The measure was prompted by concern over a wave of violence directed at doctors who perform abortions and abortion clinics. Pro-abortion rights groups say there have been 8 cases of arson, 1 bombing, and 15 instances of severe violence at abortion cases this year. Dr. David Gunn, a doctor who performed abortions, was murdered in Florida, and another doctor was shot and wounded. Under the measure passed by the Senate, those convicted of such violence would face stiff sentences, up to life imprisonment for those convicted of murder, up to 10 years if bodily injury occurs. First offenders convicted of lesser acts could get up to 6 months in jail. The House takes up a similar measure later this week. If it's approved, congressional leaders hope to work out the differences between the two bills and send a finished measure to the White House by Thanksgiving. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
On the eve of a House vote on the North American Free Trade Agreement, the White House is highlighting recent converts to the Yes column. Meanwhile, opponents are complaining about deals being made by the White House in order to win over undecided lawmakers. NPR's Mara Liasson has more on the story.
A senior White House official claimed to be single digits close to a victory. More than a dozen additional members announced their support for NAFTA today. The president continued individual meetings with lawmakers. One, Democrat Floyd Flake of Queens, New York, emerged from his meeting saying he would vote for NAFTA after the president promised to support a move to increase investment in urban areas. And the president tried to make it easier for Republicans to vote for NAFTA by sending a letter to Republican leader Bob Michael saying that it would be inappropriate for candidates to use the NAFTA vote as an issue in 1994. Opponents of the treaty complained about the deals and the letter. They told NPR they might try to kill the deals in legislation before NAFTA comes up for a final vote. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
In Somalia, UN peacekeepers have increased security measures around the capital after reports of possible car bombing attacks. Checkpoints have been set up at various places, apparently to prevent any attempt at a suicide car bombing like one that killed more than 240 U.S. Marines in Beirut 10 years ago. Meanwhile, U.S. diplomat Robert Oakley has arrived in Somalia to try to get peace talks with fugitive faction leader General Adid going again. Very little progress has been reported in talks that started last month. UN officials have accused Adid of not abiding by agreements already worked out. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 33 points to close at 3,710.77, a record. This is NPR News. A federal appeals court has ruled against the Pentagon and ordered the Naval Academy to graduate a midshipman who was expelled after saying that he was gay. The three-judge court in Washington directed military officials to commission Joseph Stefan as an officer. He had sued the Navy, but a federal court judge had dismissed that lawsuit. Chief Judge Admiral Mipka, writing for the court, said America's hallmark has been to judge people by what they do and not by who they are. A Pentagon spokeswoman says the court order will be followed, but officials have not decided if there will be an appeal. The Clinton administration has signed a deal with the nation's largest paper company to protect an endangered salamander. NPR's Philip Davis has more.
The Alabama Red Hill salamander is a 10-inch-long dark gray amphibian that lives in moist ravines in southern Alabama. A good bit of its habitat happens to be on land owned by International Paper Company. The company hasn't logged on that land since the salamander was declared threatened in 1977. In an agreement worked out with the Interior Department, the company announced it is permanently setting aside 4,500 acres of its land to protect the salamander's habitat. The agreement allows the company to log on the rest of the land in the salamander's range and protects the company from lawsuits. The deal continues the Interior Department's push to reach cooperative agreements with businesses over endangered species and avoid bitter legal battles. This is Philip Davis in Washington.
Government officials in Tokyo have announced that Japan's trade surplus advanced again in the month of October. The nation's trade surplus rose to more than $11 billion last month, and its surplus with the United States was more than $5 billion. For close to 3 years now, Japan's trade surplus has expanded every month. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Martina Spada's work and art often intersect. While working as a tenants' rights lawyer in Chelsea, Massachusetts, he also published several volumes of political poetry. His last collection of poems, titled Rebellion is the Circle of a Lover's Hands, won the 1991 Penn Revson Foundation Poetry Award. The judges called it political poetry at its best. Espada is currently teaching English at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. His new book of poems is called City of Coughing and Dead Radiators. Martina Spada recently spoke with Terry Gross. He began with his poem, Tires Stacked in the Hallways of Civilization.
Yes, Your Honor, there are rodents, said the landlord to the judge. But I let the tenant have a cat. Besides, he stacks his tires in the hallway. The tenant confessed in stuttering English. Yes, Your Honor, I am from El Salvador, and I put my tires in the hallway. The judge puffed up his robes like a black bird shaking off rain. Tires out of the hallway. You don't live in a jungle anymore. This is a civilized country. So the defendant was ordered to remove his tires from the hallways of civilization and allowed to keep the cat.
Is this poem based on a case that you handled?
It's actually based on two cases, which I consolidated for the purpose of writing the poem. But in fact, those exchanges did take place.
What were the cases about?
Well, as the poem implies, the cases had to do with both a rent arrearage and an eviction action brought by a landlord, and defenses which had to do with the conditions in the apartment and in the case of this exchange, the landlord, who was one of the more notorious landlords in Chelsea, actually did respond that I let the tenant have a cat, which was obviously his rationalization for the abominable situation he allowed the tenant to live in.
You obviously didn't like the judge very much, and in this poem, the judge is very condescending about El Salvador. Did you run into that a lot in the legal system?
Oh, absolutely. I have to say that most of the time it's more subtle than this. But the results tend to be consistent with that kind of prejudice. And there are times in the system when, in fact, the judges are very open about their biases. And this was one such occasion.
What's the relationship of your work as political activist to your work as poet?
Well, it's a very close relationship. My work as a lawyer dovetails with my work as a poet, as it has over many years, in that in both cases, I am an advocate. I'm speaking on behalf of those who don't have an opportunity to be heard. Not that they couldn't speak very articulately for themselves if they had the chance, To think otherwise would be patronizing. The poor do make their own best advocates, which is precisely why they're often prevented from doing so. But most of them don't have the opportunities I have to speak, to write. And so I take on that role as advocate, whether it's a poet or a lawyer. And I see also a common purpose in terms of documentation. Certainly a lawyer does that, and poets do it too. So a poem like the one I just presented is very much a poem of documentation as well as advocacy.
A lot of people like to blame the poor for being filthy, so filthy that they attract rodents. Other people always blame the landlord for renting a deteriorated, uncared-for housing. Do you think the truth is always on one side or the other?
Well, I would never say that the truth is always on one side or the other, but I would say that the truth is more on one side than the other. And obviously, I believe that the truth lies more often with those who would blame the economic system, who would point the finger at those who hold property, because they are ultimately responsible for the conditions. And as far as those conditions being blamed on certain groups traditionally, I have had that come back to me in very strange ways. For example, I once represented an Anglo client who had just received a notice that she was going to be evicted. Truck was coming to take her things away the following day. And just as we were about to leave from my office to go to court, she turned to me and she said, "You know what the real problem is in that building? It's the Puerto Ricans. They brought the roaches." And so I had to sit her down and give her a little civics lecture before we went off to court. And so I found myself in that position on more than one occasion.
Now, does that really surprise you when somebody who's being victimized themselves can't perceive the victimization of their own neighbor?
I wish I could say I was surprised, and yet I've seen that so many times that I am not surprised anymore. We are encouraged to blame one another rather than to blame those who are really responsible for our social, political condition. The old business of divide and rule is at work. And so it doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me when the poor do not show sufficient solidarity with one another. We have been conditioned to do the opposite.
Oh, I want you to read the first part of the title poem of your new book, City of Coughing and Dead Radiators.
I cannot evict them from my insomniac nights, tenants in the city of coughing and dead radiators. They bang the radiators like cold, hollow marimbas. They cry out to unseen creatures skittering across their feet in darkness. They fold hands over plates to protect food from ceilings black with roaches.
Why did the radiators become the central image in that poem?
Well, that's a good question. I remember where the phrase came from. I remember being in my office one day and seeing the clients in the waiting area. It was crowded that day. It was winter. And from my office, I could actually hear this cacophony of coughing. I could sense that everyone in that room was sick. And I knew that they were sick because no one in that room had any heat. It was almost a given that they had no heat. And I began to multiply the numbers I saw in that waiting room, envisioning the entire city of Chelsea coughing. And from that image, in turn, sprang the image of dead radiators. And note that the phrase is not cold radiators. These are not radiators which will produce heat in a few minutes or a few hours. They're dead radiators. They're not going to produce heat.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Martin Espada. He has a new collection of poems called City of Coughing and Dead Radiators, and several of those poems relate to his years as a lawyer representing low-income tenants. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Poet and former tenants' rights lawyer, Martin Espada, is my guest. Since we're talking about housing, what kind of apartment did you grow up in?
Well, I was born in the East New York section of Brooklyn, and I was raised in a public housing, mixed-income public housing, in that section of New York City. And my memories of it are spotty, but I do remember contemptuous references to the housing authority, which was, of course, our landlord, the equivalent to our landlord, and the equally contemptuous references to the maintenance men who never came and did what it was they were supposed to do, and so on. But what I particularly remember about those days growing up in Brooklyn was the paranoia, the fear that everyone felt, which, of course, sometimes was justified and sometimes was excessive. But, for example, the poem in this book, Day of the Dead on Wortman Avenue, is really about that urban paranoia.
Did you grow up afraid?
Oh, certainly, yeah. Grew up afraid, and there's such a close connection between fear and anger. Grew up angry as well. Sometimes couldn't distinguish between the two.
What was the first time you went to Puerto Rico from Brooklyn?
I was 11 or 12 years old. And I went with my parents to the island, believing what I was going to encounter was paradise. That was what we had always heard, simply because for the people in my family, that was paradise compared to here. So upon arrival, I was shocked to see concrete everywhere, to see that essentially the island had been paved, that there were signs in English everywhere, that the island had been conquered economically as well as politically. And I began to realize that, in fact, the people in my family on the island prized all things American, even where this meant they compromised their own identity. There's a poem I have in this book called Coca-Cola and Coco Frio, which is really about all of this, where I found myself being surrounded by relatives who insisted on feeding me Coca-Cola over and over again, as if they were giving me a very special treat, and that's the way they presented it to me. And then when I thought, just when I thought this experience was going to lapse into utter self-parody, I was taken to a roadside stand off a beach and treated to something called Coco Frio, which, as the poem explains, is a coconut which is open with a machete, and you can actually drink the milk of the coconut with a straw directly from the shell. To me, this was a revelation, absolute revelation. And the irony was that here I was surrounded by people who were celebrating this false idol, this Coca-Cola, right, which you could see all over the island, and ignoring their own miracles, which included the coconut, Coco Frio. As I say in the poem at the end, so many coconuts in the trees sagged, heavy with milk, swollen and unsuckled.
How did it affect your identity to go to Puerto Rico?
Oh, it was absolutely transformative. You suddenly realize that you have a history. A person who is not aware of having a history is like a person with amnesia. And going there affirms that you do have this history and creates a much more solid sense of identity, which in turn enables you to have the self-confidence necessary for self-defense, again, in a society which is sometimes hostile to that identity.
Was the identity, was the meaning of being Puerto Rican really different in Puerto Rico than it was in Brooklyn?
For me or for people in general?
For you.
Certainly, you feel, well, for me, even now when I go there, it is a process of self-discovery. It's a process of learning, of constantly observing and soaking up everything. And that is very different from being here, where more often the identity is taken for granted, or where more often I find myself doing the explaining rather than the learning.
You have left your work as a tenants' rights activist, at least for now. You're now at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, teaching creative writing and teaching multicultural literary studies. How do you feel about leaving your work as a lawyer?
It's difficult on one level. I will miss certain kinds of struggles, certain kinds of moments. And yet it has to be borne in mind that I did this work for 15 years, first as a paralegal and then as a lawyer. And there's a certain amount of burnout, frankly, that's involved with that. Also, I see what I'm doing as my response to a certain degree of disillusionment with the legal system, although I'm still a firm believer in using the law as an instrument for social change, particularly at the class action level. I have to say that years of these struggles has produced some disillusionment with the way the legal system really works in the world. And yet it also needs to be said that I see what I'm doing now as being part of the same struggle. Part of that same continuum of struggle.
How so?
Because essentially now what I'm doing is communicating ideas about this social political system as I have gathered these ideas from experience to a new generation of people who hopefully will help to change things.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Martina Espada speaking with Terry Gross. Espada's new volume of poetry is called City of Coughing and Dead Radiators. It's published by Norton. That's Eddie Palmieri, and this is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer joins us with a preview of what's coming up in All Things Considered. And Linda, I imagine NAFTA leads things off again.
That's right. Mara Liasson will be talking to us, Chris, about what the latest count is on the treaty. And we'll look at a district I just visited in the state of Washington, where there are two interests on opposite sides on NAFTA, apples versus wheat. We also have a U.S. Federal Court of Appeals decision on gays in the military. Itzhak Rabin is in Washington to talk to the president about attacks on Hezbollah targets in Lebanon. We'll have a review of the movie The Piano and an interview with Holly Hunter.
Okay, thanks, Linda. Those stories and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Next Monday marks the 30th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy, and television is busy marking the event, repeating old docudramas and documentaries related to JFK, and presenting some new ones. TV critic David Biancooley has seen many of them. In fact, he says he's seen too many.
10 years ago, when I had a lot more free time, I listed all the telemovies and miniseries ever made. One thing I wanted to find out was which historical figure had shown up as a character in the most docudramas. Back then, the clear winner was Adolf Hitler. 10 years later, I don't have an official count, but I'd bet, especially after this month, the new winner is John F. Kennedy. In the movies, the Kennedy canon began with PT-109, made the same year JFK was killed. On TV, it began in 1974 with William Devane playing JFK during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Since then, there have been tons of Kennedy docudramas, including one very good one, Martin Sheen in the miniseries Kennedy. That was broadcast in 1983 on the 20th anniversary of the assassination. But in 1993, there isn't much new ground to cover. We've seen docudramas on Jack Kennedy, on Jackie, on Bobby, and on Jack and Bobby fighting Hoover, Hoffa, and LBJ. We've even seen dramas about JFK's lesser-known siblings, in Young Joe, the Forgotten Kennedy, and about his parents, in the Kennedys of Massachusetts. We've seen TV dramas about Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby, and just about everybody else this side of Abraham Zapruder. Last night, NBC presented Fatal Deception, Mrs. Lee Harvey Oswald, which was an empty-headed drama about the wife of the man who allegedly shot JFK. This Sunday, ABC presents JFK Reckless Youth, an examination of Jack Kennedy's early years. Oddly enough, the best sequence is about Kennedy's exploits on PT Boat 109, bringing the whole Kennedy docudrama thing full circle. Only this time, Kennedy and company are presented a lot less heroically. Patrick Dempsey as JFK is at sea fighting a war, all right, but with one of his own men.
Randy! Take port!
With all respect, it's Randall. Not some rich man's pet. Give a cute little nickname to Sir.
Well, tell me, Randall, is there anything about me you don't like besides me being a rich Yankee Catholic Ivy League officer?
That pretty much covers it. I'd probably come up with some more if you give me a while, Sir.
Well, take all the time you need. It's gonna be a long war.
When it comes to documentaries, the sheer volume of Kennedy-related material is depressing. It seems like this week you can't turn the dial without running into one. But there is one that stands out from the pack, tonight's 3-hour PBS Frontline special called Who Was Lee Harvey Oswald? This edition of Frontline is wonderful. From start to finish, the reporting is strong, the interviews are informative, the new evidence is impressive, the conclusions are convincing. The biggest conclusion in this case is that Oswald, whether or not he acted alone, was the assassin who shot and killed JFK. On the show, after all the evidence is examined, we hear from Robert Oswald, Lee Harvey's brother.
It's good that people raise questions and say, wait a minute, let's take a second look at this. I think that's great, you know. But when you take the second look, and the third, and the 40th, and the 50th, hey, enough's enough. It's there. Put it to rest.
I couldn't agree with him more. If a TV show has something new to add, like this Frontline does, then bring it on. But if it's just another rehashing of the same old material, Oswald's brother is right. Enough's enough.
David Biancooley is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease and Peter Clowney. For Terry Gross, I'm Chris Spurgeon.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Broadway and cabaret singer Barbara Cook. She originated roles in The Music Man and Leonard Bernstein's Candide, and starred in She Loves Me and The Gay Life. Stephen Sondheim has called Cook one of the two or three finest singers of song. Join us for the next Fresh Air.